Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're getting into a book that really challenges you to think differently about, well, about the word God itself.
Mm-hmm. That's a big one.
It really is. And it might just provide the historical context you absolutely need to make sense of our, you know, often confusing modern world. We are unpacking Karen Armstrong's major work, The Case for God.
Yeah, and it's important to say up front, this isn't really a case in the sense of, like, a legal defense of religious doctrine.
No, not at all.
It's more like a brilliant diagnosis of where things went wrong. The core problem Armstrong tackles is, well, it's staring us right in the face, isn't it?
Definitely.
Why is the public conversation about faith, you know, the one dominated by aggressive atheists on one side and very rigid fundamentalists on the other, why is it so polarized and, frankly, so unproductive? Exactly. Her argument, it seems simple at first, but it's actually pretty explosive.
Yeah.
She's saying both sides are essentially arguing about a very specific, very modern idea of God.
An idea that, historically speaking, didn't really exist in the way they imagine it.
Right. They're trapped in the same sort of faulty rationalist framework.
So our mission here in this deep dive is to follow Armstrong's historical map. We want to try and recover this older, much more sophisticated understanding of God.
An understanding the Western world has largely forgotten.
Pretty much, yeah. One rooted in intellectual humility in practice, not just belief. And rediscovering this might offer some, well, some clarity. And maybe even a path toward more meaningful personal engagement with those big ultimate questions for you listening in.
Okay, before we really dive into the arguments themselves, we should probably talk about the author, Karen Armstrong. She brings a really unique authority to this whole subject.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she's one of the world's most respected historians of religion, but her perspective isn't your typical academic one.
What makes it so distinctive?
Well, her own journey is fascinating. She's not just, you know, a scholar looking from the outside. She actually spent 7 years as a Roman Catholic nun.
Right. She left the convent.
She did. And that personal experience, that wrestling with faith and doubt from the inside, it gives her this insight into the human religious impulse, that deep longing for something more, for transcendence. It's something many purely academic scholars might miss.
So she's not exactly defending doctrine, but she's not dismissing spirituality either. She's often called a bridge builder. Is that right?
That's a great way to put it. She approaches faith historically, comparatively, looking across traditions.
Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism.
Exactly. She synthesizes these vast spiritual histories. Her authority really comes from decades of work. I mean, think of History of God, another huge book. She looks at millennia of human spiritual searching and identifies these recurring patterns, these deep structures of religious thought and practice that actually transcend specific cultures and times.
Okay, so let's get into the core concept, the absolute bedrock of her argument. If you take away just one thing from this, it probably needs to be this distinction she makes between mythos and logos.
Yes. This is absolutely critical. Understanding this difference is the key to seeing how the whole modern confusion about religion really started.
So logos first, what is that?
Right. Logos is, well, it's the realm of reason, logic, science, practical knowledge, how the world works.
But if you can test, verify, fact.
Precisely. It governs the material world. It's the language you use to build a bridge, to do math, to conduct a scientific experiment. It needs to correspond accurately to external reality. It's about how.
And mythos, then, is different.
Completely different. Mythos isn't concerned with practical facts or literal history in the same way. It's the realm of meaning, purpose, art, spirituality.
So the big questions: why are we here? How should we live? How do we deal with suffering, death?
Exactly that. It addresses those timeless human concerns. It doesn't tell you how the cosmos works mechanically. It tells you what your life means within the cosmos. It operates through symbol, ritual, narrative, not empirical proof.
And Armstrong's point is that for most of history, people understood these were two different toolkits, two ways of knowing.
Yes, absolutely. They were seen as complementary, but separate. Each had its own sphere of competence. You wouldn't use a myth to figure out crop rotation, and you wouldn't use a scientific analysis to find ultimate meaning or comfort in the face of tragedy.
So where did it go wrong? The fatal flaw she talks about.
The category error, she calls it. It happened particularly in the West over centuries when people started applying the rules of logos, demanding empirical proof, literal accuracy to the realm of mythos.
Like, demanding scientific evidence for a creation story meant to convey meaning, not geology.
Exactly like that. We started demanding that these ancient narratives, these symbols, which were designed to shape our inner world, our ethics, our sense of meaning, we demanded they function like scientific reports. It's like trying to measure love with a ruler. The tool just doesn't fit the reality you're trying to grasp.
Okay, so if mythos wasn't about literal facts, how did ancient people actually engage with it? It wasn't just about, you know, believing certain things were true.
Not primarily, no. And that brings us straight to the next really crucial distinction Armstrong makes. The difference between praxis and doxa.
Practice versus belief.
Essentially, yes. For thousands of years, across many traditions, religion was overwhelmingly about praxis. That means practice, action, what you did.
So things like rituals, ethical disciplines, mm-hmm. meditation, acts of charity.
Right. Cultivating compassion, training the mind and heart. Things like kenosis, that mystical idea of self-emptying. It was a way of life, a set of disciplines you committed to. It was very much something you performed.
And Dhaka doctrine, intellectual belief, that came second.
It was often seen as secondary, yes, or even derived from the practice. The point wasn't just to intellectually agree with a set of propositions. The real test was whether the practice was transforming you.
So if your religious life didn't make you more compassionate, more empathetic,
then, Armstrong argues, based on historical views, it was considered a kind of failed religion, no matter how correct your stated beliefs were. The ultimate proof was in the ethical and compassionate pudding, so to speak, not just in the theological recipe.
Wow. And this emphasis on practice, on doing, it must have shaped how they thought about the divine itself. You mentioned apophatic theology earlier, the way of negation. That sounds tricky.
It sounds academic, but the core idea is actually quite simple, and it was incredibly widespread. Apophatic theology just means you can't really say what God is using human concepts. God is fundamentally ineffable, beyond our language, beyond definition.
So any positive statement about God is good, God is powerful, is inherently limited.
Exactly. Because our human concepts of goodness or power are finite. Trying to pin God down with words is like trying to, I don't know, scoop up the ocean with a teaspoon. The greatest thinkers, Augustine, Maimonides, many Islamic philosophers, mystics across traditions, they emphasize this. God wasn't seen as a being among other beings, even the supreme one. God was more like being itself, the fundamental reality, which our minds just can't fully grasp.
That leads to the example of Thomas Aquinas. I admit I was taught his five ways or five proofs for God's existence were these. Well, logical arguments meant to prove God exists, like a scientific proof.
And that's precisely the modern misreading Armstrong wants to correct. She argues very persuasively, I think, that wasn't their original purpose at all.
So what were they then?
They were more like contemplative exercises, scholastic meditations. They were designed to train the mind, to push reason to its absolute limits, and then point beyond reason towards the mystery of existence, towards the ineffable.
So less about winning an argument, more about spiritual training, intellectual yoga, almost.
That's a good way to think about it, yeah. They were meant to lead the mind towards awe and silence, not nail down God as a logical certainty. Treating them as scientific proofs is a classic example of that category error, applying logos standards to something operating in the realm of mythos and contemplative practice.
But hang on, isn't there a risk there? If you say Aquinas' proofs weren't really proofs, does that undermine his intellectual standing or the whole tradition?
I don't think Armstrong sees it that way. Her point isn't to diminish Aquinas, but to recover his context and his likely intent. She's showing that even the most rigorous logical minds in the pre-modern world understood the ultimate mystery, the ineffability of the divine. The problem isn't Aquinas. It's how we, in modernity, read him through our own literalistic scientific lens.
Okay, that makes sense. So if things were like that, focused on practice, acknowledging mystery would happen, what caused this huge shift away from praxis and apophatic understanding towards literalism and demanding proofs? She points to the Great Western Transformation, right, around 1500 to 1800.
Exactly. This is the period where the foundations really shift. Several things happen. First, you have the Protestant Reformation. Now, combined with the invention of the printing press.
Ah, the printing press.
Right. It had this unintended consequence. Scripture, which had often been experienced more fluidly, interpreted communally, maybe chanted, it suddenly becomes fixed, solidified into the authoritative text. People start reading it, often alone, and increasingly interpreting it more like a literal instruction manual or a book of facts, rather than a collection of, you know, diverse, often poetic or mythical narratives. Literalism gets a huge boost.
Okay, so that's one factor. What else?
Then comes the big one. the scientific revolution, the rise of logos as the dominant, almost exclusive way of knowing truth.
Newton and the mechanistic universe.
Precisely. Figures like Newton presented this powerful model of the universe as a vast machine governed by predictable laws. This was incredibly successful for understanding the physical world, but it also led, almost inevitably, to a new conception of God.
The Great Watchmaker.
The Great Watchmaker. A distant, external designer who created the machine and set it running. This God wasn't the immanent, mysterious being itself of the mystics. This was a God whose existence could be inferred from the design of the universe, almost like a scientific hypothesis. And a God you could infer. Well, that's a God you could also argue about using logic and evidence. For the first time, God becomes a debatable scientific or philosophical proposition.
And that God, that mechanistic, intellectualized God of the philosophers, that's the one Armstrong calls the straw man God.
That's the one. He's a product of this modern shift, this category error. And because he's conceived in largely rational logos-based terms, he becomes vulnerable to critique on those same terms.
So when someone like Nietzsche proclaims the death of God,
he's really proclaiming the death of that specific modern intellectualized God. The watchmaker God had become unbelievable for many thinking people. But here's the really provocative part of Armstrong's argument. This vulnerable, modern, strawman God didn't just lead to atheism. It also, paradoxically, gave birth to modern religious fundamentalism.
Wait, fundamentalism is modern? That sounds counterintuitive. How does she argue that?
It's a brilliant, if unsettling, insight. She argues that fundamentalism, which seems like a rejection of modernity and science, is actually a thoroughly modern phenomenon itself. Why? Because it reacts against science by, ironically, adopting its opponent's core assumption.
How so?
Fundamentalists insist on the literal, factual, almost scientific accuracy of mythos. They take ancient scriptures, poems, myths, things originally intended to convey meaning and value, and treat them as though they are competing scientific or historical textbooks.
So they're defending faith, but using the tools and assumptions of the very worldview they oppose, trying to make mythos function as logos.
Exactly. They are trying to beat science at its own game, but using texts that were never meant to play that game. They accept the modern premise that truth must be literal and factual, and so they fight to prove their myths are literally factually true. It's a defense mechanism born entirely out of the modern predicament.
Wow. Okay. And what about the other side of the coin? The new atheists, people like Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris.
Well, Armstrong argues they fall into the other side of the same modern trap. They are often logically rigorous in their critiques, absolutely, but the God they spend so much energy attacking, it's almost always this simplified, literalistic, modern watchmaker God.
The straw man God again.
Yes. They target the God of the fundamentalists or the simplistic God sometimes presented in popular religion. They rarely, if ever, seriously engage with the long, sophisticated traditions of apophatic theology or the understanding of God as being itself, or the emphasis on praxis over doxa.
So they're essentially knocking down a target that serious theologians throughout history wouldn't even have recognized.
In many cases, yes. They are very effectively dismantling the God created by the modern category error. But they often seem unaware of or uninterested in the deeper, more nuanced understandings of the divine that existed for millennia before that.
So the core insight, the really striking claim, is that these two apparently warring factions, rigid fundamentalism and aggressive new atheism, are actually related.
Twin children of the Enlightenment, she calls them.
Wow.
Both movements, she argues, operate under the same fundamental modern assumption that religion is primarily about belief, doxa, in propositions that must be evaluated according to the standards of reason and empirical evidence, logos. They share the same rationalistic, literalistic mindset. They just reach opposite conclusions about whether the evidence stacks up.
They're basically locked in an argument that only makes sense after that historical shift, after that category error was made.
Precisely. It's an argument that would have been largely unintelligible to someone like Maimonides or Meister Eckhart or Rumi. It really forces you, I think, to question some of our own ingrained assumptions about what religion even is.
Okay, if we accept this historical diagnosis, if we see how we got into this modern bind, what's the way out? How do we apply this ancient wisdom, this older understanding, to our lives today? What are the practical takeaways?
Well, the path forward, Armstrong suggests, involves consciously trying to recover some of that lost wisdom, especially the focus on praxis. And there are a few key themes she constantly returns to. The first one is absolutely central: compassion as the ultimate test.
Meaning, The real measure of any spirituality isn't what you believe, but how you behave, how it changes you.
Exactly. She repeats this like a mantra. If a religious practice, any practice, doesn't actively work to dethrone the ego, to cultivate empathy, to inspire that kenosis or self-emptying, then in her view, drawing on historical precedent, it's a failed religion.
Regardless of how orthodox its doctrines might seem.
Irrelevant. The judgment is based on the practical, ethical fruit. Does it make you more compassionate? If not, it's missing the entire point.
Okay, that's a powerful challenge. What's another key theme?
The need to reclaim the original meaning of faith, or pistis in Greek.
Which isn't just believing things without evidence.
Absolutely not. That's the modern, impoverished definition. Pistis in the ancient world meant something much more active. It meant trust, commitment, loyalty, engagement. It was about entrusting yourself to a path, a discipline, a way of life that promised transformation.
So faith is an active verb, not a passive noun. A commitment you make.
Precisely. It's an active engagement, a courageous commitment to walk a certain path, often in the face of uncertainty, trusting that the practice itself will yield understanding. It's not about mentally signing off on a list of doctrines you can't prove.
How does this reframing help us practically?
Well, for one, it gives us better tools for dialogue, both public dialogue and interfaith dialogue.
How so?
Instead of getting bogged down arguing about the literal truth of conflicting myths or doctrines, which is usually a dead end, you can shift the focus. You can look for the shared ethical core, the common emphasis on compassion, the golden rule, which appears in almost every single tradition. You can talk about shared praxis.
Finding common ground in action and ethics, rather than arguing about conflicting facts.
Exactly. And personally, I think understanding this history fosters a deep sense of intellectual humility.
Because it shows even the greatest minds acknowledge limits.
Yes. When you see how Augustine, Aquinas, Maimonides, the Sufis, the Kabbalists, how they all stress the ineffability of the ultimate, the limits of human reason and language, it encourages us to be a bit more humble ourselves. It makes it okay to say, I don't know, when confronting these profound mysteries. That recognition that God is beyond concepts demands humility from everyone, believer and non-believer alike.
You know, the thing that really struck me, the most surprising part of Armstrong's analysis, was that reframing of Aquinas. The idea that his proofs were maybe more like spiritual exercises than logical trump cards. That really shifts how you view that whole intellectual lineage.
It's a crucial shift, isn't it? It takes theology out of the realm of like courtroom debate, trying to prove a case beyond reasonable doubt, and puts it back into the realm of poetry, metaphor, contemplation, and lived commitment.
Yeah, it stops being about winning an argument.
Right. It asks you perhaps to stop being a kind of spiritual accountant, tallying up beliefs and proofs, and maybe start thinking like a pilgrim committed to a journey of practice and transformation, even without a perfect map.
So if we pull back and look at the entire sweep of the book, this incredible history of how, in many ways, the West lost the plot on religion, what's the final big takeaway, the provocative thought she leaves us wrestling with?
I think the final powerful message is this. The most authentic, the most compelling case for God, if you want to use that phrase, isn't going to be found in a clever logical argument or strict adherence to ancient texts read literally.
Where is it found, then?
It's found, she implies, in a life. A life lived with dedicated empathy, with intellectual humility, and with a courageous, persistent commitment to compassionate action in the world. That's the real evidence. The book, ultimately, is this incredibly learned and passionate plea to recover the lost art of spirituality. To understand that the human quest for meaning and transcendence is ancient, complex, beautiful, and fundamentally non-literal.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.